Good morning.
Morning.
The Amador County Board of Supervisors' regular meeting of February 26, 2013 will come in order. The board has gone into closed session under items 1, conflicts with labor negotiators, and 2C, SEIU Local 1021 versus County of Amador. Board received a report from staff, and the board approved under item 4, the confidential minutes of January 22, 2013. The February 12, 2013 minutes will come back on the next agenda. With that, could you all join me in the pledge?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty.
All right, thank you very much. Can we do have an agenda today, and we'll put it on the agenda as item 8A. And this is Board of Supervisors discussion of possible action relative to adoption of a resolution in support of the Second Amendment and the right of the people to keep and bear arms. This is direction at the last meeting that Supervisor Arnetto would refine the resolution and bring it back to the board. Also, under the consent agenda, item 3C under resolutions has been pulled per the request of Supervisor Plaz. With that, can I have approval of the agenda?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Boitano, second by Supervisor Novelli. Is that correct? Ted, did you? Or is that Brian? You did? Okay. All right, moved and seconded to approve the agenda. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 All opposed? Motion carries. Public matters not in the agenda. Discussion items only. No action to be taken. Any person may address the board at this time upon any subject within the jurisdiction of the Amador County Board of Supervisors. However, any matter that requires action may be referred to staff or a committee for a report and recommendation for possible action at a subsequent board meeting. There is a three-minute time limit. Is there any public comment at this time? Now we go to Supervisor Novelli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I'd like to say thank you to the road crew. That storm we had last week did a little mind-boggling work on many of the drivers trying to get home and go up the hill. So the road crew did a great job. They worked all night on that. Second thing is we had a General Lewis Ledge gathering down at the post on Saturday. It was well attended. We had many supervisors there and past supervisors, so that was well. We had a colonel come over from the 12th Naval District, United States Marine Corps, San Bruno area, gave a little speech on General Lewis Ledge. And, of course, our favorite Colonel Fraser West was there, and he had a few good things to say about it. The other thing is I just want to make it known that, in case people forgot, we still have a prisoner of war over in Afghanistan. That gentleman was captured in July of 2009. His name is Bo Bingle. And, you know, we have a lot of things going on in the world with people crossing over and borders and everything and getting rescued, but I'm still waiting for our government to try to get this young gentleman that's been captured since July of 2009 to have him come home. I'm sure his family would like him to get home. He's from Haley, Idaho, in case anybody asked. And when he was captured, he was 27 years of age. Other than that, Mr. Chairman, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other public comments from board members?
I have one. Last week we had a California State Association of Counties board meeting, and I just want to put everybody on notice. The governor and state are wrangling to take more realignment money away from us. So that's in a couple of weeks. I'll give a full report on that meeting due to the fact that I didn't have time to get it on the agenda, so I'll put it on in a couple of weeks. So interesting meeting. Fun and games still.
What a surprise, huh?
Yeah.
I know I was at most of that meeting, Lewis, and what I saw was supervisors, I think they learned from AB 109 and what happened with the realignment dollars there and with the counties having state inmates pushed on us because a lot of supervisors were very uncomfortable during that meeting. It's like they didn't want to say too much against the governor right now, but even Matt Cate, CSAC, was not ready to come out with a recommendation. But I sense that supervisors are very uneasy about this.
Well, we all now know what Governor Brown means by returning local control to locals.
Right.
Sending state responsibility for local expenditure.
That is correct.
And, you know, the problem with, you know, AB 109 is some of these people are just, you know, sex offenders are being released and cutting off their home monitorings and disappearing out and doing it again and again. So.
Well, thank you for that report, and we'll expect or look forward to a more full report at the next meeting. Any other public comment? Hearing no. Yes, ma'am. Come on up. If you could state your name and sign in for the record, please. Could you speak up just a
minute? Yeah,
can you hear me? Okay, sorry.
Need a little fine-tuning there.
My name is Leslie Smith, and I just wanted to come to introduce myself to the board today. I'm the new executive director for the Foothill Conservancy and a new constituent of Supervisor Boitano, living in Sutter Creek. Thank you. So I look forward to working with the board, and I just wanted to introduce myself. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for showing up. Any other public comments? Hearing none, then we move on to our regular agenda. Item 5. Susan, you made it just in time. APOD, you made
the
society.
Consent agenda, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Consent.
Oh,
Mr. Chairman.
You caught me on that. Sorry. I was making my notes below that. Consent agenda with item 3C pulled from the consent agenda.
Move approval of the consent with item 3C removed.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Plath, second by Supervisor Novelli to approve the consent agenda with that item pulled. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. And Susan.
Thank you.
Thanks for waiting. This is a discussion of possible action relative to board support of APOD Humane Society trap, neuter, and release program for feral cats, correct?
Yes. Thank you. The one thing that I have not told you is that for several years there have been two people who have aggressively trapped, neutered, and releasing cats, over 900 actually, in our county. And they are Suzanne Hatley and Jeff Holman. And that has had, I believe, a direct impact on our bottom line to shelter intakes, along with aggressive spay-neuter programs. What we always do is, as a Humane Society, we try to look at what other shelters and Humane Societies are doing to try to improve what we're doing. And we discovered a long-term program in Florida, which I sent you a chart of, also recently Sac County and Sac City participating in the Trap, Neuter, Release program, whereby other than the cats that our group traps through dedicated volunteers, the cats that enter the shelter in past years, and it's been anywhere from 100 to 300 cats a year, were held for 3 days, and that is a law that is being worked on right now to try to reduce for those cats that are clearly feral to allow shelters to release them earlier than 3 days. Cats, it was given to me an estimate it costs about $26 a day or $78 per cat to hold them for 3 days, and then they're just put down in the past. So what
those figures one more time, Susan, it's how much?
$26 a day.
Per day?
Per day per cat.
Whose numbers are those?
Those are numbers that came from John Vail, which were estimates made by the Hayden Bill. The Hayden Bill is a bill that requires that shelters release animals to humane societies when they request them rather than euthanize them. So at one time, I believe there was funding for that three-day hold for cats, so the guesstimate was $26 a day.
Then you followed that with some other dollar figures, seven, eight, or what?
$78. When you add the three together,
$78 for
$78 per cat, because they are now the shelter is required to hold them for 3 days. Okay? So we're working on trying to get that reduced when the cat is clearly feral, because in the trap, neuter, release program, even if you happen to get somebody's tame cat that's not been spayed or neutered, it's just kind of a bonus because you're releasing them back and they're spayed or neutered in the community, and they obviously were at large and somebody went to the trouble to trap them and turn them in at the shelter. So they would not be destroyed. They would be trapped, neutered, and released. The reasoning behind releasing them back rather than killing them is two things. It's more humane, and that cat actually acts as a space saver. Obviously, what a lot of people don't understand, these are healthy cats. Somebody is feeding these cats. In some of the instances where Jeff Holman has gone out to trap cats, the landowners have said, you know, they actually put out a mandate to their renters, do not feed the cats. Well, they went underground and kept feeding the cats, and the colonies continued to grow. So we went back and trapped more cats, took away kittens, actually had some domestic cats that had been dumped. So, you know, we're really working hard, but what experience has shown is that the colonies, such as the one that's over in the Ione Park, Howard Park, has shrunken to 5, and that was a very large colony. But they've been doing trap, neuter, release there so that they're not unsterilized cats moving back in to take up the food. So when I met with the shelter, they asked me to get your buy-in because we both benefit. If we attack this as a county program, as an APAL program, it impacts the bottom line. The shelter and the county will end up saving money because our intake is going down. Last year, our intake reduced by 151 cats. You want to multiply that by the $78 required hold, that's quite a savings. I'm not asking you for money today. I may ask you in the future if the numbers continue to go down, as I expect they will.
On your chart, on your graphs, you show that number of impounds are going down, but the number of adoptions in 2011-12 still was on the increase from 1,076 to 1,093. So is the aggressive adoption program more what's driving the numbers, or is it a combination of both, do you feel?
You know, I think we have this big pie and every piece contributes. I kind of liken this to losing weight. You know, if you're a heavy person, initially it's really easy, but once you get down to that last 10 pounds, it's really difficult. And now we're having to get really aggressive and really creative to try to get our numbers down. I think it's important when you look at the difference between 1988 and 2012 to show that we have had about a 50% increase in our population. Our economy has tanked, and yet our impounds are down by 25%. So we're doing a great job, you know. Go Team Shelter and APAL. We really are doing a great job. We can do a better job, and the Community Cat Program is just a part of that. I think one of the things for the future is going to be a trapping program where people chart and aggressively go out and trap those colony cats so that we can reduce the numbers.
Does the county fund any of this program now with the dollars that we give to APAL?
No.
I didn't think so. So are you asking for any funding? Or
no, I'm not asking for any funding at this time.
I have one more question. I'm confused about one thing. If you, I get it that it's a piece of the puzzle. If you take a cat out, you put a cat back in, it resumes its place.
Right.
But if you have a dominant male, and you take him out and neuter him and put him back in, it would seem that at least over time he's not going to be as dominant and there'll be another male to take his place.
You know, that's possible. But if we're aggressive in what we're doing and continue to spay and neuter, I can use the feed barn as a perfect example. I have my Freddie that was just a black flash in the barn for probably a year, and we tamed him, neutered him, and he now is still the dominant male after several years. Unfortunately, he fights with the cats that come around, and that's really how this works. Cats are territorial. So he still, as a neutered male, is fighting because that's his home. And so last week we spayed his new girlfriend, and we neutered the new male who had moved in. And we're happy to have them all. We also have, in those places where people who are not happy to have them, we have a door hanger that we're using to go out to solicit barn homes where people, like myself, don't mind having cats in their barns. And so if we need to take a cat that's been turned in and the people are very vocal about not having that cat back, we are working on relocating. And we've done several of those already.
You have a question on the graph you have that shows shelter data from Jacksonville Humane Society?
Yes.
Talks about total surgeries, and total surgeries is more than the total shelter intake. Is that because some animals have more than one type of surgery, or what?
That actually is...
Total surgeries are not more than the total shelter intake.
Yes, they are. Like 09-10, total surgeries was like 24,000 something. Total shelter intake was 22,000.
What that is the surgeries are not necessarily shelter animals. That's the public. For instance, APAL last year funded about 1,500 spay neuters, but that's not how many cats we took in. So we are hoping to, anything that people are willing to spay neuter, if we can help have that happen, then, you know, that's really what we want to do. So I think what they're showing is, okay, a spay-neuter surgery, the most expensive is $50. This is how we win also. Your three-day stay is $78. So you've already won if you can keep that litter of kittens from coming into the shelter. Each and every cat is going to cost you $78, but the most expensive surgery is a spay, neuter being about half of that, and that's $50 versus $78.
So basically in Jacksonville, what you have there is you have your total shelter intake.
You've incurred the $78 too.
Hmm?
I mean, you've incurred the $78 too because you've taken them into the shelter. You're mandated to hold them for 3 days. You do the surgery, and now you release them back into the population.
This is preventive. Okay, I have a public cat, and I'm spaying or neutering that cat. That cat has a potential to have about 18 kittens a year. And so I've taken that cat out of the equation and prevented that cat from having kittens that ever enter the shelter.
But that cat's still out there to enter the shelter as well.
The spayed or neutered one?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
The Jacksonville and Supervisor Onetto, I'm sorry I interrupted you on that, but that was the last year.
You'll pay for it later.
Yeah, I'm sure. But I think the point is that, Jacksonville is used as an example of how this program works. And yet, in 2005 and 2006, Jacksonville had intake of 25,355 total animals. And yet, 4,000 surgeries were done that year, 6,700 surgeries the next year, 7,700 surgeries the next year, for a total of about 18,750 surgeries. And yet, their shelter intake was still higher 3 years later than it was at the start of the 05 year. I mean,
shelter intake's at the bottom. Shelter intake is in the green. It's continuing to decline.
From 2005-06, it was 25,355.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In 08-09, it was 25,603.
Right, but as a percentage, that's really not huge. They're probably getting down to what they're going to have.
But as a percentage, I mean, what do you think if the average surgery is $50, And you did 18,751 surgeries to achieve zero decrease in shelter intake?
The 18,000 is euthanasias.
That's total surgeries.
Total surgeries is in the blue.
This is men. I added up.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
One would presume, as you are, that when you have a surgery, you've taken that breeding animal out of it.
Right.
And therefore, these 18 kittens a year or whatever it is, and so shelter intake should decrease.
Okay.
Well, if you look at it over a period of 4 years and 18,750 surgeries times $50, somebody do the math, you've had zero impact on the intake to the shelter. But I just can't see how the program, quote unquote, is working. You can pick an individual year where you've seen a decrease, but you know our own numbers fluctuate $100 to $150 animals a year,
yeah,
one way or the other. They just fluctuate.
They do, and that's why I'm not asking you for funding now. But I believe the program will work. I do have someone coming March 14th to speak to our shelter staff from SAC County, and their reduction in the first year of aggressive spay-neuter program and the trap-neuter release was 26% in cats. So I think it works. I think, you know, when you go from, when you look at the overall impact going from 33,000 animals to 22,000, I mean, the numbers are still, to me, with our little shelter, staggering. But I think you have to factor in the fact that the shelter staff's not having to euthanize these animals. The animals that they are taking in that are cats, that are feral, is the program that I'm asking you to support. And the reason I'm asking you to support it is because if it's promoted as an APAL program, just, you know, APAL is doing this and we don't have any choice but to do this, it's not going to be nearly as successful with the public. And we want the public to embrace the fact that this does work to reduce the number of cats out in the colonies. I mean, we've seen it here with just APAL being aggressive. And we've also seen that killing these cats year after year after year is not having an impact. So I think after all of these years, it really is time to try something new and see if it works as it has in other communities.
Well, I would say that we've been trying this for a number of years. And I went back to our auditor's office and checked on the spay-neuter program, the low-income spay-neuter program, but spay-neuter just the same. Since 2007, we've been spending $15,000 a year. One supervisor at our last discussion on this mentioned a business decision on this. Well, we've spent $15,000 a year for a total of $75,000 spent on a spay-neuter program here in Amador County starting in 07, 08. And in the 08 years, the statistics that you gave us, on up to 2011, so that's 7-8, that's the same 5 years time frame, $75,000 spent, and yet we impounded virtually the same within 100 as we did in 08. We euthanized 150 or 200 more in 2011 than we did in 08, and we adopted fewer and redeemed fewer in 2011 than we did in 08. And that's after an investment of $75,000 that's supposed to have this positive impact to the county shelter. So I'm just not seeing it play out.
Well, I think if you look at surrounding shelters, you'll see that they've gone up and up and up, and we've gone down. So I do really believe that it has an impact, but the economy and our growing population, I think, has had an impact as well.
You know, on that, Susan, you're saying the surrounding shelters are going up.
Yes.
I'd be kind of curious to see some of those numbers, if you ever could sometimes. And also, if they had some type of spay-neuter program or not.
Right.
It'd be interesting to know.
Yeah, I think the thing that is unique is that Sac County actually funds spay-neuter. And they've started that within this last year. And as I say, that along with the trap-neuter release program, they've achieved a 26% reduction in their cats. Now, their cats, I think, are probably a crazy huge number compared to ours. So I'd be happy to get statistics because I think it would be interesting as well.
I'll take credit for saying it's a business decision. I would still maintain it's a business decision. You have 5 years of some of the worst economy that we've seen in my lifetime. You're still going to have people out there with pets, but you're going to have people just taking their pets and dumping them alongside the road. So that accounts for a huge amount of the increase, I think, of animals out there, whether it's dogs or cats. And that's going to affect the shelter in turn. So I think you need it.
That's a hypothetical, and you have 5 years of actual data.
And that's the problem. You can't. How do you account for the economy and what's going on? I think it's common sense, though, that people that are going to have animals, I mean, we can talk to our shelter staff. They're going to be picking a lot more animals up out there. That, I mean, I've seen animals along my road, on Center Island Road, that I can't tell you how many times I've had to report dogs, usually in pairs, that are running up and down the road because somebody dumped them there.
And now I'll have to bring up something on subject but off subject. If the cat number's down too far, then we'll probably have a mice problem.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's really how we're trying to be creative and market these cats, and that's what the door hanger says, is go green, you know. A lot of the rodenticides are killing the wildlife, and these some cats are awesome mousers, not all, but some of them are, and so we're going to wineries and ag places and trying to get them to take cats so that we can reduce numbers.
Glad you brought that up. As far as the barn cat program, do you charge people to take those animals?
We do. We charge them $15 per cat, and we go out with a cage and ground the cat so that they will stay for about 3 weeks. The cat is in a cage, it's fed, it's watered, and it's cared for, and then released on the property. The cat has had, it has been spayed or neutered. It's had a rabies shot, and it's had an FVRCP shot, and if it's feral, it's had its ear clipped.
Next question, Susan. People that place cats, are they paid like a commission or any type of fee for the placement?
Volunteers are not paid, but yes, we do have a locator program where the person is paid $25 to locate a home and have a signed agreement. And if a successful cat is placed, they're paid $25 per cat.
So I had somebody who was approached about taking some barn cats, and the person has a barn, and they got a bunch of animals, and they say, yeah, they'd do that.
Yeah.
And then the person says, well, your cats are now ready, and we want you to pay $15 per cat. And the person was a little bit shocked, I guess you'd say. It's kind of like, hey, you want to bring some cats? Fine, but I don't want to pay for them.
Yeah.
And whoever, I guess we'll leave the person's name unsaid, I guess got a little bit snarky with this particular landowner.
Mm-hmm.
And said, well, if you don't want to pay for the cat, you probably shouldn't have him anyway, and ta-ta-ta, and mm-hmm. That's kind of end of the conversation.
Yeah, I apologize. That's unfortunate. But the door hanger we have and the signed agreement both tell that the cats are $15. So
this, they called somebody, said, hey, do you want some cats? The person, he takes some cats. And
okay, yeah. Yeah, if we go to the home, then we leave material that explains the program and does explain that there's a $15 charge. We, you know, anytime you give something for free, it tends to be a train wreck. Perhaps not in this case, but frequently, if people don't want to pay for something, it can be an indicator that they're not going to care for the animal, and we don't want to take them out of a situation where they're going to be put down and put them in another situation where they're not going to be fed and cared for. So that's the reason that we charge $15. But people do have the ability to waive that if they feel like it's going to be a good home.
Yeah. Well, I've gotten a lot of dogs and cats for free, and all it costs me is St. Egg hopping to pick up and going to buy a lot of dog food after that. But
well, I've gotten several horses for free, and they're extremely expensive.
I got to tell you, Susan, I'm not in love with this program. I don't think any board member is, but I mean, I can see your motivation for doing it. But those cats that are spayed or neutered and given rabies shots and released, nobody's going to catch them again to give them a a rabies shot the next year, right?
No, but when you look at it, they're out there without anything. They're not sterilized, and they've had no shots, and so this is at least the best that we can do. You know, follow-up would be really almost impossible. So.
Yeah, I'd say I don't know if we're opposed to program per se, but I don't know if we would want, if we're interested in funding. Would be my question.
Yeah.
Any other questions or?
Just a comment. I mean, I think people, education is a really important thing on this. All pet owners, that's where we need to drive this point home. I have some neighbors that are animal hoarders, and now I've got three feral bobtail cats running around my neighborhood all the time. And, you know, they just keep going to the wherever and getting more animals. And two dogs, three cats, I don't know how many birds they got inside the house. Sounds like a zoo when you walk by when the windows are open. So
probably is.
Yep, education is very important. We have a brochure that's going to be going out explaining what the feral trap neuter release program is all about and why we feel that it is superior to just killing the cats after 3 days.
All right. Any other board comments? Any public comment at this time? Susan, thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
I don't know how to put it in the form of a... I mean, are you looking for a motion here?
No. I mean, it was just a report on the program, as I understand it.
Weren't they asking for our support?
That's an impossible action, yeah.
That's an impossible action relative to...
Yeah.
Well, we always have possible action on there, but are you... Susan, are you asking for a board motion in the form of support?
I'm asking for board approval of the program.
Well, that's where I get hung up, I guess, is that I think if any individual board member wishes to, you know, stand up and say, I endorse this program and do so wholeheartedly, it's an individual board member decision, but I don't see it as a government body making a decision to support this, because the next step is to fund it.
Yeah, I'd agree. I don't have any problem with the program. I think it's probably commendable. As far as the county financially supporting it, I think I have issues with that.
Well, it's not being asked for financial support. I understand where you're coming from, but if there's any board member that would like to make a motion in favor of support, otherwise we will move on. I think that, as was stated, the board's not opposed if APAL wants to continue the program, but at this time I don't think there's going to be any formal action. Board members want to support APAL personally, they can do that also. All right. Thank you. Next item 6 on our agenda, General Services Administration discussion of possible action relative to adoption of resolutions authorizing the transfer of real property to the Amador County Recreation Agency. Chuck, want to say anything on this? Or John, okay. Morning, John.
Morning, John Hopkins, General Services Director. This item was discussed with the Administrative Committee to accept $4,500 from ACRA for Unit 109. However, because it has a greater value, it does require the board transfer or donate the vehicle to ACRA, and that's the recommendation along with a resolution for you to consider today.
Don, how's the vehicle value determined? Is that just Blue Book, or is it something realistic that it would fetch at auction? Or
yes, typically these values, we're conservative with our values. What we do it through Blue Book, we do it with the information that the mechanic gives us. And typically, when we sell these vehicles, we actually get a little more for it than what we book it as.
Yeah, the Administrative Committee put this on the agenda after it was brought to us. One of the issues we brought up is that the per capita for ACRA was $5 at its max. So it was $5 being asked for from each entity and that's been cut by 20%. So our feeling was this was somewhat of a good faith effort for the board to show that we are, even with that reduction in the per capita, we are still supporting ACRA through things like this.
Yeah, no, I'm okay with that. I think also their vehicle did die. They do take care of some county facilities and probably provide a service to the county, so I don't mind helping them to a certain degree.
I concur with that, Supervisor O'Neill. I think ACRA needs a vehicle. I know their past vehicle, like you said, has went bye-bye, and I think this vehicle with the mileage on it and everything, I think in the vehicle, which it is a small enough vehicle where you could maneuver it through the different areas of the parks that ACRA has, and I think it'd be a good thing.
And good fuel mileage, too.
Yeah.
On the other hand, as GSA director said, I don't think we want to make this a standard mode of operation because it does dig into the amount of money that's in the motor pool fund.
No, you don't want to make it a standard practice, but if there's a, you know, the value's probably overall marginal, and if there's a public benefit for it, you know, there has to be a public benefit for both, but I think there is, and you've justified that, so it's up to the board.
It will benefit. It's not like it will benefit the citizens.
But you are correct, Supervisor Forster.
I don't think we want to get into the habit of that or get into the habit of always requesting something more than you can afford or whatever. I mean, next thing you know, you'll be wanting a full-size Tahoe and you have to run for office for that, you know.
I think I haven't seen one yet.
The administrative committee looked at the overall benefit, what ACRA does, and they did administer the Prop 40 funds. A lot of money and did a good job there. So there's a lot that ACRA does in the county. Tracy, do you want to say anything before we move on to public comment?
Hey, just also clarification for Supervisor Plaza's comment about a full-size Tahoe. We don't have any for the board.
Yet.
You haven't noticed what was parked out back?
Tracy Towner, Amador County Recreation Agency Director. I want to thank you very much for considering this, and I'd love to offer our truck for surplus as a partial payment, the existing truck that we have, you know, sort of like a trade-in.
That truck worth anything?
Sure.
off of the 4,500 or off of the 6,000?
It's a 28 Dodge.
4,500.
Wait a minute. Are the tires round?
Yeah.
Yes. They're not square.
No. Okay.
I have to run it through the ABA program.
I knew it was going to die when I put new tires and brakes on it, but, you know.
I think you should call Father Joe in Sacramento and and pick that truck up.
We'll take it in and take care of it. But thank you very much for considering this and for making an exception in your operating procedures. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Is there any public comment on this matter?
Make a motion to approve the resolution and that this is not precedent setting.
Second. All right. Moved by Supervisor Boitano, second by Supervisor Novelli to approve this action and the resolution. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Move on to item 7 on the regular agenda, Environmental Health Department fees, discussion of possible action relative to staff direction to draft and process a revision to the existing fee ordinance. This did run by the Administrative Committee for, I think, the third time, I believe, and we asked Mike to just look at specific areas. So with that, Mike, go ahead.
Good morning. Mike Israel, Amador County Environmental Health Department. As Chairman indicated, this did go to the Admin Committee after it had been to the Board last November. Some of the questions that came up at Admin were, when was the last time fees overall had been revised for the department? An overall fee revision was done in spring 2006, and then there was a small revision in 2007 to water program fees, and there was a change to the school food facility fees to reflect the two inspections per year that they were requesting in order to obtain funding for the school lunch program. The fee schedule before you includes fees for the new cottage food businesses that are now authorized in the state of California. These are home-prepared foods that people can either sell directly through a Class A registration with the department, or they can sell through a third-party retailer if they get a Class B permit, and they would then be subject to inspection much like other food facilities, but they don't have the same standards for structure and equipment. They can still cook out of their home kitchen. Also included are the above-ground storage tank fees. The program was transferred to counties 7 years back. There was a $55,000 grant that was intended to cover a 3-year transition for Amador County to take over the program. That has lapsed, and that legislation authorizes reasonable and necessary fees for that part of the program. Assembly Bill 300 went into effect in 2012, and it created new standards for body art facilities. It increases the amount of inspection time and registration requirements for the operators. So new fees are proposed for that. And then lastly, at the last meeting with the board, there was some interest in modifying our fees for major land divisions and environmental impact reports. One of the clarification items that the committee asked for is if a major subdivision came in that also had an EIR, would we request $2,000 deposits? And the answer was no. A single deposit and work on both the EIR and the subdivision project would go against that deposit. And if the project wraps up before we exhaust all those fees, we refund what is surplus. If it runs through those fees, then we would ask them to replenish the deposit, much the same way that Public Works does. Are there any questions?
I'll go ahead, Ted.
I had a question. So if this AB 300 was brand new July 2012, how do you come up with $165? I mean, where'd that figure come from? This is something that's brand new as of July 2012. Where do you come up with that $165?
The July 2012 was legislation on an existing program that was established in either 1998 or 1999, whereby locals regulate body art facilities. So we've been regulating them for, 13, 14 years. What this did is establish the specific guidelines on what sinks they need, what training they need, what kind of prevention against bloodborne pathogens that they need to have in terms of training and physical barriers. All those were supposed to be developed as regulations by State Department of Public Health, but it never did happen. So the state legislature established these criteria. So it went from draft recommended standards that we were going by in the past to essentially mandated standards that are now in the law.
So prior to this, the state was supposed to be doing something and they didn't do it? In regards to
the regulations were supposed to have been developed and they did not become finalized. That's very common when regulations are supposed to be developed. It happens. AB 885 is another one where it took forever. They finally got there. In this case, it wasn't, I guess, considered high enough priority for the regs to be finalized.
All right. Thank you.
Mike, in your memo, in your second paragraph, you're talking about these cottage food businesses primarily. Mm-hmm. And the statement is that Class A facilities are required to register, but Class B facilities are subject to permit and inspection.
Correct.
So in your fee schedule for the Class A facility, the $55 target fee that you've got there, because apparently that's a registration and it's differentiated from inspection, is that an annual or a one-time fee?
That's an annual fee. They would be expected to register annually. They would bring in their menu or list of food items that they'll be preparing, their certification that they will comply with the law, and a sample of their label.
So every year they got to do that?
Yes.
And we take note of it and
review it and make sure that they comply with the law, correct?
And you give an example of what type of business is that? I had a hard time coming up with that. Is it people that go to events around the county and prepare the food at home and go to the events?
Or sure.
Farmers market include?
Right. Yeah. If somebody wanted to go to the farmers market, if they had church bake sales that they would like to go to.
Jams or jellies, things like that?
They can do jams, jellies, baked items, fruit pies, no meat pies. Nothing with custard in it, no, essentially no perishable foods. So any kind of cookies, cakes, breads, jams and jellies are eligible. Those are all items that are included in the list.
And are sold on an ongoing basis, even if it's something seasonal, like a farmer's market?
Right. They can sell from home. They can go to farmer's market. They can go to any events as long as they're selling directly, as long as they're Class A and they just register. There are no inspections. They just certify. I'm cooking in my kitchen. The cat's out. The kids are put to bed, kind of a thing. Class B, they can sell through third-party retailers. So they could sell to, you know, Safeway or something like that if they wanted. The label still has to say prepared in a home kitchen. But their home kitchen is now permitted and inspected by the department.
Are you saying that in the interest of public safety, that the little kids have a lemonade stand, they're supposed to come down and register probably?
We won't touch that one.
Why not? It's the law. I mean, if they're it's health, saving humanity, we should really go the full 9 yards.
If that's board direction, we will seek out kids with lemonade stands. I don't think that's
just a matter of how much pain they want to put us in. So
yeah, you're not going to be going to things like the Iowa Homecoming and stopping the lady from South America, that originally from South America, that does traditional food from bringing it in there once a year, right? Or is she required to be
required? No, you have to go. He has to inspect the vendors down there, correct, that sell any kind of food.
At special events, if it is a nonprofit and it occurs no more frequently than 3 days in a 90-day period, they're exempt from permits. We have guidance that they're welcome to. If they're a for-profit entity and the sky's the limit in terms of what varieties of foods that they do, they need to get a permit from our office. If they fit within this cottage foods, they can operate that way. Unless we get a complaint regarding somebody selling something somewhere without a permit when they need one, we don't respond. So whether it's a lemonade stand or somebody coming to Ion Homecoming, unless we get a complaint, we don't know, and therefore we don't contact or initiate any kind of permitting process.
But like the carnival people that set up, that sell corn dogs and stuff, you inspect those, right?
At the fair?
Yeah.
Yes,
or Ion Homecoming or Italian Picnic?
Any event that we're aware of that has a booth that is a for-profit entity, they do obtain a permit. Typically a temporary permit. Some of the booths are set up by existing food facilities in the county. Maybe it's a restaurant, and they'll set up a booth there. There's no additional charge for that. But anybody who's, a lot of these are the kettle corn guy or people that go from facility or event to event, and this is the only time he's going to be in the county. Maybe he's going to be here twice or something like that. They get a temporary permit from us.
Does your, I mean, this is kind of a, I don't know the answer to this question, so that's why I'm asking. Who's in charge of now, it's state law that you have to put how many calories, how much fat, and all that stuff is on your menu? Do you guys deal with any of that, or is that the state?
We're supposed to verify that it's there. We don't verify the accuracy. We verify okay. The information is there, though.
That was a great law then.
Right.
Mike, on the... Is there gallonage limits on the above-ground storage tank?
The program, above-ground fuel storage, whether it's in a single tank, this could even be in 55-gallon drums. Anything that's above 1,320 gallons is in the spill prevention countermeasure and control program.
Oh, that's okay.
And then if I remember right, 100,000 gallons is the threshold between self-certification and having an engineered SPCC.
Okay, yes. So above 1,320 gallons?
That's the threshold to get into the program at all, yeah.
You have a question on that.
Let me follow up. Well, that's probably payback.
No, that's okay.
Yeah, that's on the SPCC. What about the self-certified? Is there a gallonage limit? Is that the same gallonage limit?
Between 1,320 and I want to say it's 100,000 gallons is self-certified. About 100,000 is the engineered.
And under 1,320?
It is not in that program.
Okay.
They may need to have a business plan because anything above 55 gallons, 500 pounds, 200 cubic feet of gas requires a business plan. If you've got, you know, 2 or 3 55-gallon drums of, you know, solvent or something like that, you don't exceed the threshold for the SPCC. There's still some common sense things you want to do in case one of your drums leaks, but
yeah.
You don't have to develop a plan.
Okay. Right. You know, question on the, getting back to the retail foods deal. You have a cost on $55, estimated cost to register. That seems a little bit high to register. I mean, where does the cost come in? If somebody's coming to register, I think it should take, it shouldn't cost that.
That is based on our current hourly cost. Billable time currently costs the county for staff, currently costs ballpark $110 an hour. We assume that's going to take about a half an hour.
And well, when you figure staff time, though, you're also figuring probably high-level staff to register.
It's all averaged. In 2006, the last time we did a holistic fee revision, we hired an outside consultant, and at that time he came up with an hourly cost of $96, which is still our hourly rate. Most of our fees are based on $96 hourly rate, and if we do any work that's on based on time only, it's at $96. Updating that to today's cost, because health insurance has gone up, PERS has gone up, everything has gone up, pushes us up in the neighborhood of $110 per hour. So that $55 is assuming a half an hour, and that assumption compared to most other jurisdictions I'm aware of, because Butte County did a survey, is very low. Most other jurisdictions are assuming an hour, some an hour and a half for the registration. We're definitely at the low end of what other jurisdictions are either already charging or planning to charge for both registration and permit under cottage foods.
Any other questions from the board?
Yeah, I have one more. So when they register, how exactly is that keeping the public safer?
They are registering with public health. They are telling us what food items that they are planning to sell. We check them against the list of approved foods. They commit that they're going to essentially keep the kitchen clean. They're going to keep the animals out. They're going to keep the kids out so that there's no distractions, no hair, no dirt, debris getting into the food items. When they label their foods, it will say where it's from and identify that it's made in a home kitchen. That way, if somebody has a complaint, hey, there was a Band-Aid in this loaf of bread that I bought from Joe Schmo's, you know, home bakery, we can follow up because we can track it.
It's after the cat got out of the bag.
And yes, the Band-Aid.
There was a finger in the chili.
The Band-Aid and a loaf of bread has happened in Amador County before.
Wouldn't an annual registration like that, Mike, pretty much do the same thing? I mean, you've educated this person as to what the kinds of foods they're allowed to do under this Class A program is and isn't, and, you know, cleanliness protocols and so forth. They've let you know that they're doing this. I meant to say, wouldn't a one-time registration like this be sufficient to provide the level of instruction that you're looking for here?
I don't think it would be adequate to provide the level of instruction we're looking for. If you wanted to direct staff to no charge, if it was the same operator, same location, same menu, same everything, second year, if you wanted to no charge, second, third, fourth year, as long as things remain consistent, that's something that, you know, you could certainly direct staff to do. If you want to alter the fee from $55 to something else, that's certainly something that you as the board could do. I'm just looking to try to recover as much cost as we possibly can.
You know, I like the thought as far as maybe if there's no changes or menu, the fee is a one-time fee. Or maybe if they do like a minor update, could the fee be less?
So whatever the board would direct.
Just think if somebody has resorted to trying to bring income into their house by baking cookies out of their home and so forth, $55 a year seems a little much, and particularly if you know they've gotten a list of allowable foods to produce in this method from Environmental Health in advance. They've gotten a list of cleanliness protocols and so forth and labeling requirements. Once they've got that, it doesn't seem like there's a need to continue to re-educate them every year. You've provided them that information on how to comply. They register, and they're done unless they make some major deviation from
it. What are you looking at then? Possibly the $55 registration fee the first time and no annual fee after that, or a renewal fee that's a lot less?
Same menu.
I kind of agree with what I'm hearing here, but let's just say that person at home making those cookies increases the cookie making from 1,000 to 5,000.
Do you still think that there would be no use for them to go from year to year one to year two?
There is
increase the cookie.
There is a sales cap in order to qualify for this, and there's no feasible way to monitor it. But basically, after several, I think it starts out at 35,000 gross sales per year, and it goes up from there. And I think the cap ultimately is 50,000 gross sales per year. But regardless, it is intended for what you said to enable folks to make a little bit of extra money from home,
doing what they do. Welcome, right?
Yeah.
You know, I like the director supervisor Plaza's going as far as maybe making a one-time fee, and possibly what you might do is maybe send them an email or send them something in the mail, just saying, just reiterate, hey, these are the law we must follow, and leave it at that.
So what I'm hearing is a $55 initial fee, and as long as there's no substantial change in the menu, then no additional yearly fee would be charged.
I'd be better with
under
that.
The review,
but they would still come out. Would you guys still go out or not?
No, Class A we do not inspect. They register only. The only time we inspect is if there's a complaint.
Okay.
So your language would tell them then online that as long as there's no substantial change, it's a one-time registration and inspection?
Correct. So if they're doing cookies and they want to add bread, not a big deal. If they change ownership, they change location, and they change menu, then we'd probably be looking at a new registration.
Well, let's say with jams, the guy I buy jam from when he comes down to Ione, mm-hmm. he has like 30 different kinds of jams. Let's say he adds five new jams. Is that a
jam? Is jam? I don't care what flavor it is. It's the same.
When you say change locations, you mean where they're cooking the product,
right? Yeah, and they're supposed to be cooking in their home kitchen. So if they move, you know, if they only move, but everything else is the same, is that a substantial change? Probably not. But if they have a significant number of changes, or if they want to go from Class A to Class B or something like that, then we would consider. But I don't see being able to feasibly draw a line because they went from 12 varieties of jam to 20 varieties of jam. If they totally changed, say if they were doing jam before, now they're doing baking or vice versa, then we might want to say, yeah, let's register again because it's kind of a different process.
Okay, so question, if they were doing cookies and they went to breads.
I don't see that as being substantial.
If they're doing brownies and they added pot to it, there might be a problem.
I think that's a zoning issue.
As long as you got a medical card.
All right.
Can resist that.
Yeah.
Any other board questions?
One on the subdivision issue, Mike. Is there? I've heard land use define subdivision as somebody taking 80 acres and making 240s. Is that
no.
how this is being
this
interpreted?
This is major subdivision. So it would be anything that is not a parcel map. Parcel maps for small parcels under 40 acres is up to four
up
resulting
to four,
parcels.
I.e. the Subdivision Map Act, like
correct.
We discussed
yeah.
last
so time. Five or more small parcels
be
considered a major subdivision.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? All right, any public comments? Hearing none, board members, action?
Well, do we need to do put this in form of a resolution and bring it back?
An ordinance. We currently have an ordinance. So if the board says so directs, I'll draft an ordinance reflecting the fees as discussed today and come back.
As I'm hearing, with the only change being the low-risk food Class A, the changes suggested that this would come back to the board in the form of a resolution and ordinance change request.
And I'd ask that subdivision be specified as creation of five or more parcels.
Sure.
As per Subdivision Map Act.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
That direction is given to Mike then. So bring this back, Mike, and we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Okay. Thank you much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
All right. On to the next item 8, administrative agency discussion of possible action relative to potential board direction to the county administrative officer regarding presentation which will outline the current budget and provide a brief outlook on the 2013-14 budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wanted to start off by apologizing for not having this ready 2 weeks ago like I had on the agenda, and I apologize to anybody who showed up in anticipation of that this presentation. We had some last-minute errors that came to light. And I wanted them to make sure that this presentation was accurate as possible. There are a lot of projections in here. Certainly, they aren't the final numbers. And in Maria's defense, what I thought were errors ended up not being, for the most part, errors. So I believe this is a good tight budget right now. We have some very accurate numbers, very specific projections. That we've got here to show you. Anybody who's listening at home can access this PowerPoint presentation online. It's on the front page of our website right now under the news section. Both the presentation is in PowerPoint and the presentation is in PDF format, and the budget memo that I've given to the board is also there in PDF format to download and follow along. I have tried to stay out of the weeds in terms of keeping a high-level picture here to show you where we are and what's brought this situation about, what's going right and what's going wrong. All right?
Okay.
The 12-13 budget, where we are currently, if you remember correctly, what was approved by the budget was $2.53 million beginning fund balance. That's the carryover. We had projected revenues for 12-13 of $33.04 million and expenditures of $35.6 million. There were 238 general fund positions approved in that budget and 359 positions total for the county. That's what was approved. Now, at this point in time, projecting what we're spending as out of that budget, you can see this slide right here shows where we stand relative to the year before, which was fiscal year 11-12. Fiscal year 11-12, through period 7, we had actually collected 54% of our projected revenues. This year, we've collected 51%. Ultimately, we project that we're going to be right at the 99% point by the end of this fiscal year versus 103% of 11-12. That demonstrates that we are being very accurate in our projections for revenue versus underestimating revenue, which is what causes a 103% collection rate. So you can see the collection, the actual total collection number for 12-13 is almost the exact same as 11-12. The percentage just is what changed.
Are you going to go into on revenues on things like sales tax revenues?
I'll show you some trends on
that. Revenues, okay.
Yes, sir. Okay, and expenditures. The expenditure side is. We're also doing well on. You can see that expenditures are down from last year. We are down. We are spending less. But we do know that there are still some big-ticket items that we're going to be paying for before the end of this fiscal year. We still anticipate we're going to spend 94% of that budget before it's all said and done. We are still projecting a total expenditure of about $1.3 million less than we spent last year. So we have reined in the spending a good deal. We are accurately predicting the revenues, and I think we can do some good predictions into the future. We'll show you. Go on and go to the next slide, Maria. Property taxes. Now, this is just property taxes. You can see the trend is still downward. There is a dip in 09-10 that was caused by another one of the state schemes in order to keep their cash flow up that ended up necessitating the county send 8% of our property taxes to the state to keep them afloat. We securitized that. When you see the total revenues, you'll see the what happened there. But that explains that dip. If you actually put it in the trend line, you'll see a nice smooth curve there. But you can still tell that this year we are projecting the total property taxes at $13.7 million, whereas in 08-09 we were at $15.1 million. So that's $1.4 million difference in property taxes. And that is property tax revenue to the county.
Oh, that's not total.
No, that's not total. That's okay. To the county.
Chuck, could you say that figure again? We're difference by how many?
If you look up top, the actual numbers on the top of that property taxes sheet, the numbers are there. So those are millions. So 12-13, we're projecting $13.7 million in property taxes. 08-09, $15.13 in property taxes.
Sure. Thank you.
The difference there is about $1.4 million. That's the decrease we've experienced just from property tax alone.
That fiscal year 10-11 doesn't make a lot of sense why it jumped up that year.
Actually, 09-10 is really low. And it's low because the state made us give 8% of our property taxes to them so that they could keep their cash flow going, and they allowed us to they paid us back over time. We then secured that so that we got that money back. I think there was a massive CSAC push to allow smaller counties to do that. It dips down because that's an actual number, but there is another revenue line for securitized Prop 1A, I think it was, funds. And that if you increase that by 8%, it would fall right in line to that smooth curve. So if you look in the budget, there is a budget sheet that shows the actual assessed value of all the property in the county, and that does follow a smooth curve. It's trending downward just like that one is, but that explains why that drop was there. I had to do some research in it when I saw that. Sales tax. The issue with it looks worse than it is because the vertical scale here is not compressed, but it's expanded because the range is so small. But those are actual numbers, and why it dropped in 10-11 and popped back up in 11-12, I can't really tell you. We are projecting for 12-13 based on what we've received to this point at $1.9 million in sales tax revenue, which is exactly the same amount we received in 08-09. So that is running along a rather flat trend.
Is there any way for us to research what caused that pop in 11-12?
We can. I can dig into that further. I'd like to
figure that out. The loss of our car dealerships?
Well, the pop was upward, though.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
I was trying to figure out.
That was, were they after that?
What did we do right that might have resulted in increased sales tax revenue?
Well, could that possibly come about from some of the RS stuff, maybe?
I don't know. Maybe Joe knows. It shouldn't be sales tax, though.
Yeah. Sales tax, Joe?
Joe Lowe, auditor. It's probably the triple flip. The state gives you an estimate every year how much that is. So that year they could have adjusted. It would have been higher what the triple flip is. That's what it is. That doesn't, it's not, it won't be settled till I think 14-15, the triple flip.
Mm.
That's when they take a quarter of your sales tax. So it might have been the year before it was under, and when they adjusted it, you get more triple flip. They're always making an estimate for the whole year.
Okay.
So that's probably what it is. That's my first guess without looking at it. The triple flip might have been only $400,000 that you had to adjust with the adjustment, and then next year what jumped back up to the triple flip, what they were going to take was $800,000.
Okay.
So we can't do it until they settle up the triple flip.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Next slide, Maria. This is total revenue collections. This is not total revenue or total financing sources, which is the total of
this chart plus our carry forward. If you add these, this chart's an annual carry forward, then you get the total amount the county has to spend for its budget.
Does this include realignment?
This is all just general fund.
Okay.
Everything I'm talking today is about general fund. The realignment, with the exception of a few places where general fund is being affected by some realignment, everything I'm talking about today is general fund.
Okay.
That is the issue we have to deal with. As you can see, the total revenues coming into the general fund have decreased. 2008-09 was the last happy year, as it were. It's in the $36.4 million in revenue this year. We're projecting $32.9 in actual revenue to the general fund, which means that the total amount that we have to spend is down by, what is that,
$3.5 million.
So that's more than 10% of a decrease since 2008-09. And the good news is that it looks like it's flattening out. It actually has been rather flat over the last couple of years, and that's good. The problem is that since this doesn't reflect the total revenue or total financing sources, those total financing sources are still going down, and we'll talk about the impact of that here. But the net effect of where we are right now is, Marie, you want to show us the next slide? This is where we stand right now. We're down to, we're projecting $32.8 million in revenue for 2013-14. The unreserved balance, also known as the carry forward, we're projecting it at $900,000.
Can we get consistent on what we call that?
I'm trying to be consistent. Yes, I'm not doing a good job of that. The reason it's a habit of mine to call it carry forward, but in the budget document itself, it's called the unreserved balance, and that's what the state calls it per the County Budget Act, so that's what we should call it. But it is basically cash on hand at the end of the year. But that we are projecting at $900,000. Last year, for the 12-13 budget, which is this current fiscal year, it was 2.5. So that has dropped. There are a couple of things that are affecting that number, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But that gives us our total funding sources, total financing sources, of $33.7 million, which is significantly less than we had last year. Now, projecting forward for the 13-14 budget as far as what we would be spending if with a status quo budget, all positions maintained, no retirements that we anticipate, no changes to the spending patterns or any of the other items, We are projecting a $35.1 million expenditure requirement, which gives us a deficit of $1.4 million. At this time last year, we were sitting at $3.5 million. So things are certainly better than they were last year. I think we are closing in on plugging that gap. Certainly next year, unreserved fund balance cannot be too much less than $900,000. So I think we're getting better. Marie, can you go to the next slide? The big question is, what has caused the deficit? That's obviously the first question. And the decrease in that unreserved fund balance is a big contribution. The revenue has stayed relatively flat, which I showed you earlier. But since our expenditures continue to be in excess of revenues, that fund balance keeps getting smaller year over year over year. And as a result, each successive budget will get smaller until eventually the fund balance the fund balance goes to zero, or the contingency, effectively. And the revenues equal expenditures. That's where we need to be. That's our target. That's a sustainable budget.
right now we are still not there. I do believe we are getting close. So I said the same exact thing. Well, I didn't say I thought we were getting close, but I did say that last year the fund balance would continue to decline until revenues met expenditures. I thought we were a little bit closer than we were, and the $900,000 balance is a bit lower than I thought, but we can make it work. PERS costs did go up, and the public safety units have offset their increase. They are paying 1.5% more towards their PERS than they were before, and they will continue to pay for the next 3 years. Each year they'll pay 1.5% more towards the employee share until they pay the entire employee share. So I do appreciate the fact that that they are making that step, and I'm sure the board does too. The another issue we've got that's caused the deficit is we have to build the contingency back. I am proposing a $500,000 contingency here, which is at 1.5%, and I'll get in that later again. But right now our contingency is sitting at $230,000. So those are funds that have to be taken out of the revenue in order to build that to $500,000. So that contributes a couple $100,000 towards the deficit, and the health insurance costs have gone up by $250,000. So that's another contribution towards the deficit.
In 1 year?
In this year, yes.
Wow.
So the change in PERS rates, it wasn't as bad as we thought it was going to be when they made the shift from the 7.75% anticipated rate of return down to 7.5%. That was done by the state. That's a little bit small and hard to see, but on your sheet you can see what the change has been. You can see the safety tier two. Has been a very good tier towards the budget in terms that they are paying paying a third less than safety tier one is, and safety tier one continues to climb. Safety tier two is being held static. The prosecutor went up a little bit, but not too terribly much, and the miscellaneous unit went up 1.3 percentage points. So that's the same as if everybody in the miscellaneous unit got a 1.3% raise. So that's what it costs the county.
This is, as your note, the employer's share only.
Correct.
So for all of these positions, the county is paying from 16.2 to 32.5% of the gross payroll.
Yes.
Of that employee towards their retirement.
And in a number of these, actually all of these, I do believe, we are still paying a portion of the employee's share. The safety tier has negotiated to where they that is being transitioned to a full employee paying for the employee's share, but right now we are still paying for a portion.
What the new laws they passed last year, everybody's supposed to contribute by 2016, correct?
That's the standard, yes, but that still has to be negotiated.
Right. Oh, it still has to be negotiated, is it?
Yes, sir.
Carte blanche. Okay.
Yeah.
That's AB 340. Chuck, I had one question in regards to these PERS rates. So if their actuarials go up, that affects this rate, correct?
Yes, these are our out of the actuarial that just came out a couple months ago.
Okay, PERS was just advertising, or not advertising, stating over the weekend that they have a $1 billion deficit in a city called East Palo Alto that they invested in, and they're concerned about the $1 billion they lost down there. So with that said, that could change this upcoming year in regards to these change in PERS rates, correct?
No, the 13-14 rates are locked in.
Okay.
They've given us proposed 14-15 rates. The 14-15 rates could change, but the 13-14 rates are locked.
Okay, thank you.
What you're saying is that PERS pumped $1 billion into Palo Alto's economy, huh?
Got a redevelopment investment or something, Ted?
It was in the newspaper. I was reading it for 2 days. It's pretty shocking. I think it's a little bit about both.
You ever been to East Palo Alto?
Oh, yeah. Now you know why.
Disappointed you didn't report that under your public comment time.
Okay. So the plan is I've proposed it here that has led to that deficit. We are, and I'm trying to emphasize this strongly, we are using as accurate a revenue and expenditure projections as we can find. We are not making, where we can make an assumption versus putting together a very fine estimate, we are putting together that fine estimate, which is part of the trouble we've had to this point, because it has been a new system that we've developed for the most part. We have had Becky come back and give us a hand to double check us, and I think she found some issues we had, but I think for the most part we were in good shape. And I thank Maria for sticking with me. We've struggled through this.
Not a girl.
Yeah. I don't have much hair on my head left to begin with.
We never had any.
Yeah, I have even less now.
Come on, Chuck. You were like that when you first came here, so don't be giving us that.
You're doing good. You're doing good.
But actually, I do like
work on the sides.
I do like that idea, Mr. Eiley, as far as keeping, calling the numbers what they are is what they are, and no gimmicks. A lot better off in the long run.
That's what we're aiming at.
Yeah.
We're our
accuracy without getting rosy, though. You know, accuracy but staying conservative.
Realistic
in estimates. Yeah.
Conservative, not overly conservative, but accurate, and not we're not going to try to play games.
You have a tough job to do. Okay, when it comes to those numbers, so you do what you got to do. If you got to call back more staff or call back people to get your numbers straight, so that you could tell this board what they really are, you got to do what you got to do, and I give you kudos in regards to keeping those numbers and being true to the numbers.
Well, thank you. The back to this budget plan, another tenet we've got here: one-time revenues for one-time expenses. If we do have some sort of a windfall, it will go towards one-time expenses versus using for recurring expenses. The only exception to that is going to be this next line, which is the state triple flip fund reimbursement, which is we are going to use that for recurring expenses, but those did come from recurring expenses. So that's the righting of a wrong, as it were.
Yeah. Hopefully, but that still has to be passed through the legislature. And the good news is we're paired with San Mateo, so we've got a better chance.
People do tend to listen to San Mateo a little more than us.
Are we looking at the same amount this year, 1.1 for the county and 300,000 for the cities?
Yes, sir. Right about there. The and I am recommending that we leave that in here at this point in time. It is in the governor's budget at this point in time. If it makes it to the May revise, I think we're sitting pretty good. We do have a lobbyist who's focusing on that issue. He is pretty confident that it's going to stay in there, but he's not confident that we're going to have a permanent fix for this situation before San Mateo really wants a different fix than would work for us. And I think right now we're better off just going year to year. I don't like it, but it's I think our best solution right now.
Well, unfortunately, there were some legislators who weren't around in 2004, and they let us know that, and they don't care what happened in 2004, any agreements that were made. Unfortunately, there were some legislators who were county supervisors and city council members in 2004, and they don't really care about any other entities that where these glitches came up and caused issues. So we are having to pay the lobbyist costs, not an exorbitant amount, but money well spent in this situation.
Well, I think we should remind the legislators who weren't here in 2004 that in 2009-10 they still owe us money.
That doesn't carry a lot of weight. Bring it up.
So the assumptions that I've made here, I believe, are conservative assumptions that are not too rosy and are not too negative. It assumes no increases or decreases in property tax revenues. There are some places that are still going down in terms of property tax valuation, and there are some that are going to be reassessed, particularly some large development areas around here, and they will see some significant increase. Right now, I'm just going to project a flat same rate, same number as last year. So that's what I've included in the revenue plan right now. I'm also assuming sales tax is going to continue at the current rate. You saw the slide where it goes up and down, almost seemingly random. And I'm going to assume that we're going to hit the 13-14 number will be the same as the 12-13 number. One thing I meant to mention with that slide, if you look at the budget book, the sales tax is actually split into two locations. There is sales tax that goes directly into the public works, the road department budget. And so that number that shows going into the general fund is not 100% of the sales tax. That slide I showed you was 100% of the sales tax. So it gets split. We had a maintenance of effort requirement. The maintenance of effort requirement is not there anymore. So, but the revenue was still split. So it was split last year. It's always been split. Just in case somebody's checking what I'm saying at home.
That's the Prop 1B funds, right, that goes to the Public Works Department?
They're run by Prop 1B.
Yeah.
So sales tax continues at a certain rate, at the current rate, and I also assume no changes in the pay structure of the miscellaneous unit. The contract with the miscellaneous unit expires in September, at the end of September, and negotiations per MOU are slated to begin in June. So I don't know if we're going to have a answer to that before this budget is approved. So right now I'm assuming no increases in contributions towards PERS. I'm assuming no raises. Whatever is decided out of those negotiations, we'll have to deal with in the budget. So those assumptions. The general fund contingency is set at $500,000. This is 1.5% roughly of the total general fund budget. Previous years we've set that amount at 3%, which would result in a $1 million contingency. We historically have not had to go to the contingency very much. And the most we've had to dig out of it any year, I believe, was $260,000. So I believe a $500,000 contingency is ample. If an emergency should arise, we still have a $7.5 million reserve outside of the contingency. We could touch that. I'm not advocating touching that for any other reason. I'm going to leave that, recommending we leave that reserve the same as it is right now and has been for the last 3 years. Various funds will also be required to budget. The different realignment funds, the enterprise fund at the airport, health, the water development, county improvement will all need to be budgeted within their current costs. There is not going to be any contribution from the general fund for these things. Times are too tight. There are too many places that need help right now that we won't be able to cut from, and making contributions to the various realignment funds beyond our mandated level of effort is something that I think we need to frown upon right now. And I am recommending that we leave the hiring freeze in place. We've kind of been sliding away from that of late. I think we need to retune that up and make everybody come through the board again for approval. to hire, particularly from the general fund positions, because the for example, the social services or behavioral health positions, I don't really aren't savings there are not going to help the general fund, but the general fund positions should be reviewed by the board.
I've already informed you, Chuck, of one workshop from that CMSP is having next month regarding health care, but what Supervisor Boitano brought up with the realignment dollars possibly being cut for the health funds, that's a big concern. That could shatter a lot of budgets out there that are tight already, and we don't need any surprises.
Just for clarification, when you say for the health funds, is that for the what CSAC's talking about, public health and environmental health?
Realignment
that
funds
health
that come in.
Trust realignment fund or whatever they call
right.
it. Yeah.
Because we can do it cheaper than the state, according to the governor.
Give it to you.
Yeah. Wash their hands of it.
Okay, so anybody sitting in the audience isn't going to be able to read that in any way, shape, or form, and I apologize for that. There actually are copies of it up here, and it's online, but it's a pie chart that's broken into many, many pieces to show who's getting what chunk of the general fund costs. So you can see who's getting what. We've had to do some grouping in order to make it so that you could actually read it at all, but it's a pretty good representation of what's going on and who's getting what. So you can take a look at that offline. If you have any questions, feel free to ask me. I don't anticipate that you would be able to chew on that and digest it right now.
One thing was the education one, Chuck. I think if I can tell the color differentiation well enough, it shows 2.2% of our...
Yes, sir.
I mean, I know our property tax is largely...
That's over. Library in the co-op extension.
Oh. Okay.
If you look to the side, it shows who's grouped into what color there.
I'm sorry.
So, over on the right. Yeah, so...
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So our where do we go from here? On March 4th, the budgets are going to go to the departments. We're going to have set up targets for everybody to hit, just like we did last year, based on costs to the county. So if you are in a department that is completely covering your costs through fees or grants or whatever, then you would not experience cuts. Just like we did last year. March 18th, the departments will have to get those submittals back to me. And the 25th to the 29th, I will sit down with the various department heads to meet with them and discuss what they've given to me, if there are any significant changes in those budgets. And I'm proposing a budget workshop the week of April 16th. I think we could do it sooner if the board wanted to. It's just a suggestion from me. That does leave us the week of April 30th. For a second budget workshop, if the board should want. Both of those weeks are off board meeting weeks. That's why I've set them there. And then following that, I believe we can get our budget together and have a budget hearing on May 28th. That does leave us two more meetings after that to get that budget passed before it has to be passed. So we can, particularly schedule around the budget workshops, we can alter that down the road as need be. But that's just a big picture right now. I don't anticipate that this is going to be a process as difficult as it was last year. I'll leave it at that.
Well, I would hope that the trend is along the lines for all department heads that you know, we're all in this together. And I guess it's easy to get sort of immersed in your own world and your own departmental budget and that being your only concern and wanting to maintain it and so forth. But I think the way Chuck has put this together where it relates directly to the draw on general fund is a real good way to look at it. And I just hope that everybody realizes that we're all in this together and that whatever they can do to find solutions and help the situation rather than bemoan the conditions that we're in, we're all better off in the end. Helps everybody.
No, I would agree absolutely with what you're saying, Supervisor Plaz. And I think it is something department heads should look at. They're not just operating a department or taking care of a department. Basically, as a whole, we're providing services to the citizens of Amador County. And that's we're not just funding our department or protecting our department. We're supposed to be providing services to the whole, to all the residents of the county, and I think that's something they ought to keep in mind.
Well, I think you can say the same thing about the county as a whole. All employees, everybody, have to realize that we're all in this together. And it's far from being over. These are really tough times. So everybody has to keep that in mind.
Absolutely.
I want to thank, you know, Chuck, Maria, Becky, for all their hard work. Last Thursday night I had LAFCO, and I got through with the meeting, I think it was last Thursday, and I come up, and it was late, and Maria was still working, scared the heck out of me. I didn't know anybody was in the office, and she come walking out of there, and I jumped about 3 foot. So I appreciate all your hard work.
Yeah, I'd like to echo that as well and comment that just in my short tenure here, this is one of the best budget presentations I recall having. Very, very clear, very understandable, shows where we were in the past, where we're at now, and where we're headed. So well done to everybody involved in it.
And where we got to go.
Yeah. Well, the one of the changes that I want to make, part of the problem with the whole budget is that the County Budget Act mandates certain forms, certain bits of information that are out there. And we meet those requirements, but we don't do it in a pretty fashion. And there's a lot more information we can convey, and I'm going to make that attempt to have extra sheets. You know, relative to the cost of the budget, having extra sheets in here is not going to be a lot. So we can use lots of words. Words are free, and to explain what we're doing so that the public understands where their tax dollars are going. And I think that's one of the obligations we have to the public, is to make sure they understand where it's going, and they can judge themselves, and then redress you for change your decisions.
Well, I think the public will appreciate that. We do, and there's so many governmental budgets that you can't make heads or tails of. I think sometimes they purposely do that, so you can't figure out what they're doing. But I think if we do it right, and people will very much appreciate it.
Supervisor,
their tax dollars.
Had your hand up for some time.
I'm sorry, Ted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No problem. I just want to say that, also, too, is what you hear out on the streets that, housing is turning around, this is turning around, everything's turning around. A lot of that, I believe, is a little on the fake side, because it might be happening someplace else in the world, but I don't think it's happening in Amador County, as we say.
And, Chuck, you acknowledged it, but I think the board's appreciative of the employee units, too, recognizing how bad the economy is and working with the board on resolving our budget situations.
I concur with that, Mr. Chairman. I think all the county employees that are working for the county know that these are tough times for all of us here in Amador County, and I think they're all helping to strive to do the right thing for Amador County.
Any public comment on the budget or discussion? Hearing none, Chuck, we'll wait with anticipation then for the budget hearings after you meet with department heads and bring that back.
So the week of April, I think we should probably plan on it. The week of April, what would they have?
The 16th?
Yeah. Is that adequate? I think that gives us adequate.
Well, you also made a comment that if we could do it sooner, so it's your call.
I think the 16th is a good time. It still gives us enough time. If problems should arise, then we've got, it still gives us 3 weeks to float.
Okay. I have two meetings down on that day already, Board of Equalization and Amador Air District. So we can run that week, the
Tuesday, yeah.
Week.
We can make sure we can work around those.
Yeah. Well, we could have the meeting in the afternoon, can't we, Chuck?
Yes, sir.
Tuesday is the 16th.
Oh, Tuesday is the 16th?
Tuesday is the 16th.
Okay.
And we've got Air Board at 1:30.
Well, historically, the board has had all the department heads come in. We've gone through each budget. This is the one that can take a while, that first budget meeting, budget workshop. So I can work with the chairman, and we can figure something out.
Is other supervisors have air?
Thank you, Joe.
That afternoon,
I have air district at 1:30.
Why don't we try to? We have Board of Equalization at 9:00. Why don't we try to get that air district moved up to the AM and then have budget workshop that afternoon?
Yeah.
So we have the whole afternoon to devote to it if we need to.
I think that's a good idea. Maybe like make it 8:00 or something.
What?
Air district.
Never get here on time.
Well, if you got Board of Equalization at 9:00.
Yeah, I think Air District, we could probably have it 11 o'clock. Those usually don't take over an hour, 10:30, 11 o'clock. So let's work with the Air District and try to get that meeting time moved so we can do workshop in the afternoon. Okay? All right, we'll work on that as a scheduling item. The next item on the agenda, let's try and finish this up by 11.
Can we take a break?
You really want a break? We only have two items left.
I think he really wants a break.
All right, we'll take a break. This will be a quick break. What the heck? 10 minutes.
Need a break?